Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
August 21st, 2016, and welcome to episode 135 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting, and also complaining about Skype. My name is Jack, and I'm joined by two illustrious members of the roundtable. Let's start with the one who is farthest forward in time, Michael in Australia. How's it going?
Oh, it's pretty good here. It's the late end of winter, so the weekends are glorious. The backyard beckons for weeding, and that's what I've been doing, apart from building PCs.
Nice. You know, I saw you posted on Facebook sometime a week or two ago a picture of, like, I think some wallabies in your backyard. And every time I see something like that, it's like, it amazes me, because I'm so used to having people who are my friends who are either in North America or Europe, and they might post pictures of things in their backyard, animals, but it's never a wallaby or a kangaroo. But with you, it is. Which is awesome.
Yeah, yeah. A few people have sort of got a bit jealous, but the wallabies are not available for relocation.
All right. Also, over on the east coast of America, we have Paul. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. The rain has subsided, I think, briefly here.
So good.
All is good.
Good, good. Well, in Sweden, the rain is just starting. It seems like summer is very much over. We're into the gray winter that is called fall, and that's it. It was okay while it lasted. That's the best you can ever say about summer in Sweden. It was okay while it lasted. But anyway, on to the show. The main topic we want to talk about today is the IBM PC, which recently celebrated its 35th anniversary. 35 years ago, the IBM PC was launched to the world, or was presented to the world. I don't think it was actually put on sale 35 years ago, but it was shown, put on display. And we have a link in the show notes to a nice article about this from The Telegraph. And they mentioned that the first one that was actually shown on display had a whopping 16K of RAM, which seems like, I mean, we all know, I don't think I've ever saw a PC with anywhere near that small amount of RAM. But it's interesting that IBM already is as late as 1981 thought that that seemed okay.
Well, they had all those extra bits.
Sure.
At twice as many bits.
Pretty crazy. But so yeah, so the initial the first IBM PC, the 5150, it cost about $1,500, which is over $4,000 today. Which is pretty hefty. And I remember, like, at that time, I was not really interested. I was not into computers quite yet in the terms of knowing what was available. But I know that a couple years later when I started, I was like, wow, those things are so expensive. And when I actually got a chance to sort of use them and play with them, from the perspective of what I wanted to do with the computer, I thought, wow, these are really expensive and really terrible.
That's pretty much how I felt when I used my first IBM PC.
Yeah.
I was sort of going, and why can't I bring my Apple II to work?
Yep. Yeah, so the I guess the first IBM PC that I remember actually sitting down and kind of trying out and playing with a little bit was probably at a cousin's house in about 1983, I'm going to guess. And it's, like at that time, I think it was starting to be pretty entrenched. People knew what it was. And I'm not sure if in 1983 if there were any actual IBM PC clones available yet. I don't know exactly when they started to appear. But
my impression is that it was pretty quick.
Right.
Actually, yeah.
And I guess the reason for that is they were using a lot of, there were some third-party things, like they didn't have their own operating system, they were licensing it, which meant you could also license it or buy it yourself. And I remember at the time, they talked about, well, the reason people can make clones is because the IBM PC uses off-the-shelf parts. And I remember, again, you know, I was like, whenever I was, 10, 11, 12, 13, when I first heard this, I was like, okay, off of what shelf? Like, who has... where is the shelf that contains these parts that are an IBM PC?
Yeah, where is the shelf, and why haven't I got to play with it?
Right, exactly. What kind of shelf? So, I don't know. I guess that was the way of saying that there were things that were more or less generic, like they didn't have custom proprietary video or audio chips or anything like that, so it was a fairly open platform, which led to the world of the PC clone.
Mm-hmm.
What sort of memories do you guys have from the early days of the IBM PC?
Well, the early days for me sort of mirror pretty much what you were just saying. I started working at a large Australian insurance company, and this was even before personal computers were on everybody's desk. Those people that did have something on the desk, it was a terminal, back 3270 terminal back to the mainframe. The PCs were of any flavor were rare, and the first one went into the accounts department. I suppose they were looking at it from the spreadsheeting perspective, but I did get to try it out because the branch accountant realized or knew that I was pretty much into computing and just wanted to get someone's opinion on it or was showing off, and went up there, had a look, bit of a play, and I was suitably unimpressed. pretty much... not long after that, I moved into the technical services department, and that was where the central IT was, and you know, I was doing all my programming back on the mainframe, and these PC things kept popping up, and I was still unimpressed, because I was already using 400, 800K, 3.5-inch floppy disks on my 2C, and... thought 5.25 were no good. I had much more storage space available on my personal space up on the mainframe, and they just started popping up, and then they started appearing with the connectivity cards with the coax out the back to the cluster controllers, and funnily enough, most people were actually using them as green screen terminals, which I thought was strange because I was already using a 4-color terminal. They just started creeping into the organization and eventually taking over. Didn't really have much time for them until IBM bought out the PS2 range on the microchannel architecture. That's when I felt that IBM had a PC that was worth talking about or worth using. And that was when I started using the PC a lot more. But I thought for a computer that had a pretty uninspiring start, that it did sort of make ultimately make quite a large impact on the world. So I'm actually sometimes surprised it actually lived long enough to make that impact. Right. Though possibly it was the clone market that made the impact rather than the IBM personal computer itself.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. IBM got it into the business doors.
Yeah, no one ever got fired for recommending IBM is what they used to say.
Right.
Right, exactly. And, you know, so my own experience with, so I guess I did have a friend in high school, I guess, that had an XT. I actually never until, you know, recent days, didn't have any experience with an actual 5150 of the first sort. But the XT came in, I think a year later. And there was a high school friend of mine whose parents used it for business at home. And, you know, occasionally he would, you know, run graphics demos or something on them. You know, they would play whatever PC games there were. But, and I guess I had there was an XT and an AT at work, where I worked doing, programming So there, you know, that was, it was, I could see it adopted it. You know, in my mind, it was still, you know, it sort of divided into the business computer versus the non-business computers, and the IBM PC was the work computer.
Right.
So,
Michael, you mentioned something interesting. You mentioned when IBM picked up the PS2 architecture. Could you maybe explain what that was a little bit? Because I'm very fuzzy on that, because I was still not into the PC realm at all at that time. And I remember, you know, everyone knows what the PS2 keyboard connector is, but like what the other aspects of that, I am totally blank on.
Well, back before they came out, the ISA standard was what all the peripheral expansion slots were in those machines. Mm-hmm. So IBM bought out their wider bus, the microchannel architecture. So it was considerably superior to the ISA, but they put it out as a proprietary technology, and you basically had to pay licensing amount money to IBM. And as good as it was, it basically limited the peripherals that were available to those that were either sourced directly through IBM or a few manufacturers that were making it. So IBM held on to that for their PS2 range, and I'm not actually aware of any other desktop PC that used the microchannel architecture. And then when PCI came out, which basically offered all the advantages of MCA, that was pretty much it. And you know, we're all familiar with the PCI, PCIe, briefly, was it the PCIe? I can't remember the one that was in between, but that was pretty much it. And I loved my PS2 Model 70. That was my favorite IBM PC of desktop of all time. And it was quite a good little workhorse. Had it optimized to the hilt, but yeah, that was, you know, that was it. As far as I'm concerned, that was it for the IBM PC. After that, everything else that was PC compatible for me. You know, I was one of those guys in the family who, you know, had his PC, and when I upgraded something that released a part that went into someone else in the family, extended family or friend's computer, and that part moved along, and you know, it was nothing to sort of like to buy a new video card and then sort of like bump video cards through three or four other machines, or, you know, sure. I put a larger hard drive in and you know, bump it along, or, you know, they were interesting days. I don't bother with doing that anymore. I just concentrate on my own computers, but, I became more of the PC clone guy. This is before I got back into retro computers, as a hobby.
Right. I guess that's one thing that I was thinking about this when we started talking about this was, I mean, IBM started this segment of the market, and at some point the clones took over completely. And we were talking a bit before we started recording that like the last IBM PC device that I can recall was the ThinkPad, which they sold, or whatever they did, moved the licensing over to Lenovo, which was the company that was always manufacturing the ThinkPads. And thinking back before that, the last time I remember actually seeing an IBM PC of any kind is probably the early 90s. Like, it's just not a thing that, you know, it became all clones at some point, pretty much. Which is interesting, because I mean, I guess these days IBM does not sell anything that is like any kind of PC-like device. I don't know if they sell hardware at all, except for probably still mainframes.
I think they still do their own RX. So basically, Lenovo took over all of the IBM personal computer business in 2005, and then they increased that to all their Intel-based server business in 2014.
Okay.
So, IBM are just doing their AIX and their mainframe. I suppose there's still the iSeries, I believe that was the AS400s. So I believe they're still doing those.
Sure.
But I haven't really seen a modern. I'm only familiar with the older AS400s. Haven't actually played with anything a bit more current. I mean, more of a mainframe guy. So on their Z series machines.
Right. It's actually interesting that when I think about this, that we were talking about that back in the day that the IBM PC was the business machine compared to the other machines, which were more the fun machines. And I think about it now, and most of the people that I am in touch with are programmers who are, a lot of them, doing their work on Macs. And a Mac is a sort of a PC. in the sense that you can like install Windows on and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But most people that I like in sort of my peer group, if they are diverging away from using a Mac as a Mac to use a PC for anything at all, for any reason at all, they're using a PC to play games on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there are plenty of games that are only on Windows or on consoles. There's an interesting sort of flip there. Like there are plenty of people in who I know who will use a Mac for all of their work and switch over to a Windows PC for some gaming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see a possible path. I don't know if this is actually what happened, but with IBM first introducing the PC, the clones making it possible to buy them cheaper and make them widespread. Everything at work is now PC platform. You can sort of justify getting a PC at home because it's for work. And then everybody has a PC at home, and then game developers develop for the big market.
Right.
But, I don't know if that's actually how it happened, but I can see that being a path toward getting there.
Yep. Sounds like
sort of strange. Yeah, I was going to say I wasn't entirely down on the PC when I first encountered the XT at work. I mean, I even though I did think of it as the work computer and it's not the fun computer, I was quite taken by it for work purposes, for programming, and I really kind of liked the MS-DOS kind of architecture was new to me. I mean, maybe it had pieces that came from CPM, but I didn't know CPM at that level. Mm. But just the idea that you had all these sort of independent modules that if you had a card, you could get the module that goes with the card and everything would work. Unlike on the Apple II, where everything is pretty, pretty locked down and you have to have like a completely modified DOS to use some extra thing. Mm. I guess maybe later on they were moving into having drivers and things. So maybe my comparison point on the Apple II was a little bit further back, but I do remember being kind of, impressed with the flexibility and the way things worked. Although I also remember not enjoying setting the IRQs and all that.
Yeah.
Oh, that was painful.
But
yeah, those were brutal days.
Yeah, I used to have to, a lot of that, I basically put large, I think they might have even been floppy disk labels on the insides of the computers I was working on. And I used to write all down all the IRQs, how they were set up. And with working on so many machines, you tried to work to your own standard, but sometimes you just had to make a few changes for what is this person doing with the computer, what have they got in it, so how do you get it all running. But between IRQs and then playing with config.sys and
loading order,
fucking around, yeah, moving things around, so as long as you load them in this order, it works.
Thing is, I mean, so I know that when I was doing it, I was kind of just blundering around, I only kind of knew what was going on. I think if you pretty well understood what the IRQs were doing and why loading order matters and stuff, it might have been okay. But, I was a little, junior high kid.
Right.
So.
No, well, it was the clones really that got me into personal computing, the availability, the price. I basically would go down to any one of a number of local dealers that they'd sold whole machines, parts. These days it's not quite as many little corner stores with PC components these days. Though I suppose the big difference is that even if there was, most of the stuff that I'm ordering, I order it online and have it shipped to me. I don't have to rush out and buy a bigger hard drive or a new video card. It's just something I just like pick what I'm looking for, find out availability, put the order in, be it eBay or just a direct online seller, and normally within a couple of days it's there and it's ready to go. So but yeah, it's just in the 90s was pretty much IBM PC compatible world for me. I still had my old Apple II, but it was sitting in the corner, not getting much love, and everything else I was doing was basically PC compatibles, DOS, and then onto the early versions of Windows and Windows 95, and a few little hiccups in the operating system line after that. But you know, I was using basically our little clone friends for quite a large chunk of my personal computing time.
Yep. So, anyway, happy birthday, I guess, IBM PC.
Yeah.
Yep.
I'm surprised you made it this far, but I'm happy that you did.
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it definitely ushered in a whole different world of computing into people's lives in a way that the previous 8-bit machines had not really done. Only us nerds took to the other things.
Yeah. Yeah. One thing on that. Before the IBM personal computer came out, most of us were referring to all of our computers as personal computers.
Right.
But once IBM came in and launched the PC, then they pretty much took over. You know, these days you say, I'm either using a Mac or I'm using a PC. Or, you know.
They really co-opted that term. They're like, okay, personal computer, that's ours. You guys are doing something else. We've got the personal computer right here.
Yeah, we like it. We're taking it. It's ours.
If you can trust Wikipedia, under the success heading, it says that Byte reported a rumor that more than 40,000 were ordered on the day of the announcement. And John Dvorak recalled that one dealer that day praised the computer as an incredible winner, and IBM knows how to treat us. None of that Apple arrogance. So I guess Apple had that. Apple has always had that label.
Right. Yep. It's been there forever. All right. Cool. Well, let's move on a bit. We have a bit of listener feedback. We heard from someone about John Draper gave a talk called Captain Crunch History. Who sent us this?
This it was Jan, I think. This was a video from VCF Berlin 2015, and I think there was actually another meeting since then, but the video didn't. I'm not sure if the video worked. At least it wasn't on that site, but. So he just wanted to remind us that this was there if we hadn't talked about it before. And it's a pretty cool video. I kind of skimmed through part of it earlier today. And it's basically John Draper, who's Captain Crunch, you know, talking about his relationship with the phone company and phone phreaking. It dives into his you know, experiences with Steve Wozniak. And I think he was it Fortran or Forth? I forget which one of those four languages that he wrote a compiler for. Mm-hmm. And he basically just sort of like talked about a lot of stuff, but it was a recent recap. It looks pretty interesting. And that site also has a remote presentation that Lee Felsenstein did for that same conference. And then and a number of presentations that are in German that I found impenetrable. But
right. So. Cool.
Anyway, yeah. Thanks, Jan, for sending us that. I don't think we linked to it before, but if we did, who cares? You know, watch it again.
The more the merrier. All right. Let's move on to some items of interest. Michael, you have got some Amiga news to kick us off here.
Yes. I've always been quite impressed by the Vampire accelerators for the Amiga. And here is some good news for Amiga 500 owners. You too can have a Wii accelerator for your machine. So it brings pretty much the same specs as the Vampire 600. So you've got digital video out, fast IDE, SD card support. So this is just something that I just love seeing is these accelerators being built for our retro computers. And every time I see something come out for any of the machines, I'm just got to dive in and have a look. And it really just shows how far and what you can do with the FPGAs. So to all you guys and girls out there who are working with the FPGAs and bringing them into our retro machines, a big thank you from me. But yeah, it definitely looks like a good one to have. The Amiga 500 is one that I would like to have personally. I think it's pretty much the machine that I like out of that range.
Right.
I've got to find some space to put it in first. But
well, once you find the space, the good news is that's probably the most common model, right? That was literally the workhorse, the one they sold the most of. So
yeah,
should be pretty hard to find. I'm pretty excited that this upgrade exists for the 500 as well, simply for that reason. Like, when we were talking about this before, and it was for the 600, I was like, well, that's cool, but where am I going to find an Amiga 600? But an Amiga 500, they're actually pretty easy to find. They're kind of all over the place. So, and that the upgrade is basically the same kind of upgrade as on the 600, offering the same, pretty much the same things. It seems very nice.
All that same wonderfulness for the Amiga 500, though.
Yep. Very cool.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in this. I don't know what, a few months ago, got an Amiga 500, and I managed to get it to start up. You know, I got an SD card, you know, floppy emulator and a composite out box, and, you know, like, I managed to just set it up enough to make it run. Mm. Oh, and a power adapter. That was a little bit of a trick.
Yeah.
But I am quite... Depends on how much this costs, I suppose, but I am quite interested in bringing this to the 500.
Yeah, do we know what the previous one cost for the 600? It was cheap, right? It was pretty cheap. I remember we talked about it before, and we were surprised that it was as cheap as it was, but I don't remember.
Yeah, there's no pricing on this one yet, but hopefully if it's very similar specifications to the 600, it's going to be down in that hundreds of dollars range rather than the many, many hundreds of dollars.
Right.
The thing I'm looking at says £150 for the Amiga 600 Vampire 2.
Yeah.
So unless that's outdated, that's probably in the right range, though.
That's around the, sounds, I think, right. It was around the 250 US mark, I think they were saying at one stage. Just trying to remember the current exchange rate for the Australian dollar to the pound is not exactly great.
Although the pound's been taking a bit of a hit recently, maybe now's the time to buy things in pounds.
Yeah, who knows? But yeah, I was using an Amiga 500 at a local Amiga user group, and of all the machines that I tried, that was the one I liked the most. But as you said, you had your composite adapter and all the other power brick and everything hooked up. It was a little bit clunky. This just seems quite a nice compact way of getting it all back into the one console.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Cool. Paul, you've got something else, an article here about Gopher, which is something that is interesting because at my previous job, we would actually talk about Gopher quite a lot. It's something that would come up in discussions. Hey, remember that thing? And and I've just sort of, I have a loose memory of having used it a bit before. It was essentially something I forgot about for 20 years.
Yeah, it's interesting. So there's an article in MinPost. Actually, I didn't go to try to figure out what MinPost is, but yeah, it's probably some regional news source. Is it? I'm just curious to see if it's associated with the University of Minnesota. It might be. But at any rate, it has an article that seems to be called Obsolesced, but the subheader is the Rise and Fall of the Gopher Protocol. And it was published just recently, August 11th, I guess. And it kind of goes over the history of Gopher, primarily sort of talking about the exploits of Mark McCahill, who I guess was sort of central in kind of bringing this about. And it's sort of talking about the problem, you know, of sort of interconnecting computers and finding things on there. And apparently there was a 1992 conference where Tim Berners-Lee presented, you know, the World Wide Web, and they also presented Gopher, and I think there were a couple other things. WACE sounds sort of familiar. I forget. Mm. Yeah, WA is probably Wide Area Internet Service. I don't know. But yeah, so one of the things about this article that struck me that somewhat surprisingly is that I really didn't quite realize 1992 sounds pretty recent to me. I didn't realize, like, Gopher, I think of as like an old dead protocol, but it's not a very old dead protocol.
Right.
So, and apparently it was on its way, basically to taking over what the web does now. They talk about, I think it was McHale mentioned that at some point he saw a web address on the side of a bus and realized, okay, that's the end of it for Gopher, because Gopher is not well suited for advertising. Mm. And that's going to be what makes the difference. So Gopher, I assume people have mostly heard of Gopher, but it is a little bit web-like. It was set up at the University of Minnesota, and it was called Gopher for many reasons, one of which being that it's the university's mascot, but also that it's kind of like, you know, the name for someone who goes and fetches stuff, you know, and it's burrowing through their web. And actually, I think one of the people who was involved in this even came up with the term web surfing. Paul Lindner, I think, was the one who was responsible for that, and not web surfing, but, you know, surfing the internet. Mm-hmm. in response to, you know, talking about the Gopher experience. But anyway, it's a pretty long article, but I found it pretty interesting. I had a bit of experience, I guess it turns out, right at the beginning of Gopher. So Gopher was a bunch of nodes. Basically, there were directory sites that would link off to other sites that would link off to other ones. And usually the sort of top site was the University of Minnesota Gopher site, the mother Gopher, which I think it said also was originally run on a Mac SE 30, which also made the university kind of upset because it wasn't running on a mainframe, you know. But and I think later it was, you know, something like 10 Macs of various sorts. But and somewhere around 2000, 2004, maybe, it got turned, Mother Gopher got turned off. So, but anyway, I worked a little bit at college doing the local college node and trying to sort of set up a particular, you know, math, computer science set of Gopher nodes. So I was employed, I was paid to do this for a summer. Yes. Anyway, what experiences did you have with Gopher?
I just kind of remember using it also at college, but it was kind of like, I remember around the same time frame that I saw Gopher was also when I first saw the World Wide Web, and neither of them seemed super interesting to me. I think actually, well, Gopher seemed a bit more in line with things like FTP, right? It's a little more, it was kind of like, mm-hmm. just a notch above FTP in some sense. It's like a little bit of extra structure around how to organize information you're grabbing from somewhere. So I think that appealed to me a bit more than the World Wide Web appealed to me at the time. But I can't say that I use it for anything useful that comes to mind, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Pretty much the same thing here. I was came into sort of like being aware of and using Gopher at pretty much the same time as I got my first ISP account. I, you know, used it for a little while and then basically just stopped using it. I just found it. It was like, to me, it's like file transfers with structure. Mm-hmm. That's similar to what Jack was saying, but. To me, I just sort of like came in to both of them at pretty much the same time and just went down the www. Nowhere near as catchy as Gopher as far as the acronym goes. I always liked that, the whole sense of, you know, where it came from. And also, as you said, Gopher being one that fetches and carries and brings back and whatnot. But basically just didn't do enough to catch and hold my attention versus the World Wide Web, even though it was a very small World Wide Web at the time. But that's where I went. So I had an account with one of the first ISPs here in Australia, Aussie Mail, and I must admit I signed up to that more for getting an email account rather than surfing the web or anything. Yeah, that was those fun early 90s, mm-hmm. where everything was new and everything was just sort of like jockeying to try and to make it in that big, hard world.
Right. You know, I think we all agreed that the name Gopher is much better than the name World Wide Web. And now that the actual, since the Gopher itself is actually dead and gone, maybe it's time for us to co-opt the name, like IBM did with Personal Computer. And we'll just call the World Wide Web, just call it Gopher.
Yeah.
I'd be happy with that.
I think there would be people who would not be, I predict. It says, in the spring of 1994, web traffic overtook Gopher traffic for the first time.
Mm.
Its reign had lasted 3 years.
Yeah, that was probably me switching over to the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
It's all my fault, folks. Sorry about that.
You were the tipping point.
I was the tipping point. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
There are still, even now, you know, some Gopher servers around, but they feel a little bit like, I'm not sure exactly where the root is, because the University of Minnesota was the, you know, the top
right.
node, basically. So, but I would like to find somewhere, at least, you know, the college Gopher stuff. I don't think I actually preserved much of that, unfortunately. And it's probably on tape that's been thrown away.
I did not even know you were doing that at the time, which is kind of surprises me. I should have known. Or if I did know, I forgot.
Yeah. In fact, I was doing this on the Next, come to think of it.
Sure you were.
So I had my foot in both Gopher and, you know, the WWW world. Yeah. In fact, I think we said that we had the Tim Berners-Lee, you know, web browser.
Yeah.
On one of those Next, didn't we? I think so.
Yeah, we did. I specifically remember Roger Kirshner showing it to me, and I was so unimpressed. And he was so excited. Yeah. And I was like, this web thing? Nah, that's not going to be a thing.
Well, it seemed like a toy. Or it seemed like either, you know, somewhere between a toy and useless.
Yes.
It's a technology demonstration.
Right.
This is interesting. What can we do with it? Okay, guys, run with it.
Yeah. So, yeah, obviously that some things did come of that whole web thing. It might stick around for a while yet.
So let's see, the PC, unexciting and won't go anywhere. The web, unexciting and won't go anywhere.
Our third time lucky?
Yeah, so how about things that maybe won't go anywhere, which is encoding software in barcodes to print in magazines? To distribute software.
Yeah, it sounded like such a good idea. But yeah, I think we can make the call on this one. It's not going to work.
No, but it did work for a while. Michael, tell us about the cause and soft strip thing here.
Okay, depends on your definition of works. But yeah, back in the day when computer magazines actually had programs for all us guys and gals to type in because we couldn't afford to buy them anywhere, a company came up with the idea of actually encoding into the printed magazine the actual program, so that you just drop your scanner on top of the barcode, press a few buttons, and whiz, bang, clunk, and suddenly you've got your program entered into the computer. I think the whole idea was that you would be able to mass produce and put out your programs this way. It wasn't just going to be for program listings in a magazine, but it was a good way of advertising it. So that was, in a nutshell, the Carls and Soft Strip. It didn't last that much longer. By the time I thought about maybe a group of us could put some money together and buy one of these so that we could scan in the listings, mm-hmm. It all sort of like dried up, disappeared, and that was the last I heard about it until, well, for myself, maybe a couple of years ago when I sort of came across a Nibble magazine that actually had one of these listings in it, and I thought, oh, I wonder what happened to that company. And funnily enough, they hadn't survived the test of time. Popped up onto eBay and saw that you could buy the scanners. They came up every now and again. Mm-hmm. But probably same thing as myself. We have here a link to an article. Someone wanted to find out how did it all work. So they wanted to reverse engineer the actual the soft strip encoding. So they've gone through, they've put in, you know, where they found it, the hardware.
Mm.
They've gone through and they've given us a breakdown of the D-bit encoding and then some samples, and then a breakout of that as to how it's all done. And it seems to be such a wonderfully inefficient way of actually putting it down on the page. You know, I know that they had to worry about the quality of printing and whatnot, but I think they could have come up with, I suppose they're trying to incorporate the tracking and everything into it at the same time, because it was, you know, you put the scanner on top of the page and then the head traversed down the actual device on top of the page. But it was an interesting piece of technology back in the day, and I think it's I'm more interested in the article on actual pulling it apart and what they've done. It's an interesting little piece of history, and I think this is one of the ones which I'm not overly upset that it didn't actually go anywhere.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting little footnote. I never was aware of this back at the time. To whatever extent these were actually used in any magazines, it was only, as far as I can tell, for Apple II, for Mac, and for IBM, which none of which I was using at the time. So I did not know about this until the first I ever heard of this was January of this year, when it was actually featured in the Antic podcast. They have an interview with Bob Brass, who was one of the founders, and with Peter D'Amato, who was manager of OEM and VAR support. So actually, there was, I remember hearing about this. They had some interesting details about how they built this, how they designed this thing and made it into reality. Could be a fun listen if you're interested in how this thing was done. And we have a link to that in the notes, of course.
Cool. Yeah, this was Chris Osborne. I remember seeing this. His Twitter ID is FozTex. So I remember seeing some of this going by as he was working on this. So does it feed it itself, or do you have to run it by hand? Like, is it a...
It feeds it itself.
It's basically just a box with a scan head that moves within it, and you sit it on top of the barcode printed in the magazine or that on separate printed strips. Mm-hmm. And you know, you get it all lined up with the header of it. Press the button, and then it basically scans it in. So, you know, the usual thing is, I think it's sort of like hooks in at the keyboard, and effectively it's scanning and typing it in for you.
Aha. Cool.
I think
so, too.
Yeah, as I said, it was an interesting idea when I first saw it appear in the Nibble magazine, but it just seemed to be too much extra overhead. I thought, well, I might as well just type this in. At that stage, Nibble magazine was putting checksums in, so you could actually type in the program, and you could run it through just a little checksum generator and just to double check your syntax. Though normally running it and getting syntax error was a pretty good help. But,
right.
And some of those checksums weren't that great for me, because I was one of these people who sort of like modified the code as they went. I know I should have done the whole program just as it was listed in the magazine, then started fiddling with it. But sometimes I just couldn't help myself and just started doing my own tweaks as I was typing the program in.
Sure. Yeah, I think I see what you mean. There is that extra hurdle of this kind of device that... It's a bit of a chicken and egg problem, right? Magazines will only use it if enough people had it, and people won't buy it unless it's being used.
Right.
I think that's enough of a hurdle to make it this thing kind of automatically fail. To me, it's a bit like, I see this even today with things like QR codes. Like, it's very easy to print a QR code, but it's nothing to make people use it, because I guess maybe Android has QR code reader of some kind built in, but like the iPhone does not. And sure, I can grab an app on the App Store that reads a QR code, and that will make it open the link. But to explain that to like one of my parents or one of my siblings, like, oh, you should go to the App Store and do that, and they'd be like, well, wait, why? Why do I? If someone just wants to show me something from a magazine or from out in the world, like, why should I have to download some weird app just to be able to take a picture of a code? Like, it's not really for someone who's not interested. It becomes sort of a useless thing. Like, who cares about that?
Yeah. By the time you see the interesting QR, the QR code on the interesting panel on the side of the bus, by the time you reach for your smartphone, even if it has got the software in it, the bus has gone down the street, and you go, oh, I'll Google that when I get home.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And then you forget even that.
Right.
Yeah.
Dumb world. All right. Paul, you've got something else here about some anecdotes about why the IBM PC used the Intel 8088 to begin with.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring this in. We got a feedback suggestion quite a long time ago from Steve, who pointed out this article from 2011 called Why the IBM PC Used an Intel 8088. And it's not, I basically just wanted to point out this article that was pointed out to us. It sort of talks about the stories and primarily the talking about the difference between IBM's story about why they picked it and Microsoft's story, who says basically that Microsoft caused IBM to pick the 8088 because they were they first convinced IBM to go 16-bit and then convinced them that since it had to be 16-bit and the Motorola 68000 was not quite ready with even more bits, then the 8088 was the one to pick. So IBM had some other story that didn't involve Microsoft driving the train, but at any rate, you can read it. It's pretty short, but I just wanted to get this in there, and thanks, Steve, for sending it to us, like last year or something. But
all right, good. Well, I think that's all the news we have to share today, so let's move on to more things. But first, a word from our sponsor.
The very first computers seemed as big as houses. And so mysterious that for most of us, the computer was behind a closed door. But IBM was thinking how to make the computer more useful. And as one good idea led to another, it began getting smaller, faster, less expensive, and easier to use. Today, a new IBM computer has reached a personal scale. A person can afford it. A person can put it anywhere. Office, home, or school. And a person can learn to use it with ease. IBM made its personal computer to help a person be more productive, to help a person be more creative. And those are good reasons for a person to feel good. The IBM Personal Computer, now at selected stores across the country.
And we're back. So that IBM PC commercial featured a Charlie Chaplin impersonator, not the actual Charlie Chaplin, just an impersonator, leaning on a table, the tulip table, very nice designed thing, all roundy and
modern.
Very modern-y in the early 80s, I guess. And there's a replica of this available to buy for just under $700. That might be Australian dollars. What are those worth? A penny? I don't know. I don't know if this thing is expensive or cheap, but it is available. We'll have a link in the show notes. This would be a great gift for anybody who likes to have a very nice, futuristic-looking piece of furniture to put their computers on. Or maybe you could have dinner at this table. You could pile up books on this table. Whatever you want to do, it's actually a table.
Or put your 5150 there.
Put your 5150 on it. That's what I'm going to do. All right. Moving along. Let's hit some eBay auctions. Michael, you found some relevant items based on some relevant to some of our discussion.
Yes. Because I was so enamored by the Vampire 500, I thought I'd just go and have a quick check to see what was available. Now, I could have just linked to any run-of-the-mill Amiga 500 sitting out there on eBay, but I thought, no, let's make sure that our new vampiric experience is going to be working. So my first link is to an Amiga 500 motherboard, which has been fully serviced and is ready to go. So you can slide this one back into the case and be assured that when your Vampire 500 arrives, that you can plug it in and you can be computing at speeds before unheard of.
Nice.
Yeah, it's the usual deal. Our machines are getting older, and if you want to use them, you've got to take a little bit of care, a little bit of recapping, a little bit of cleaning, a little bit of servicing. And if you're not up to that, there are people out there that offer this as a service. So this is from Vintage Systems, and this, to me, looks quite reasonable. $130 US for a serviced and ready-to-go Amiga 500 motherboard.
Cool.
With 2 megabytes.
Yes, with 2 megabytes on it. So, definitely ready and rearing to go. So I kind of figured that you need to take appropriate care of your Amiga 500, especially once you put the Vampire in. Mm-hmm. So as we all did back in the day, we used to have dust covers for everything. So my next link is a dust cover for the Amiga. So once you get it all, you can just take this out new in the box and cover it up and protect your investment. Or you could find someone in the family to crochet you something to go over the top. I'm sure someone's nana out there will just love to crochet something for a computer. And, of course, there's the ever-reliable GoTech floppy emulator. So I've included a link to that. It's one of my favorite peripheral emulators. So plug this in place of the floppy drive and you'll be able to put the your USB flash drive in and use it like your floppy driving back in the day.
Cool.
So my little kit for getting yourself Vampire 500 ready.
Nice. Yeah, it looks like a nice little set of extras for your Amiga 500. Cool. I actually quite like, I like the dust cover. It's actually, it's very, I was expecting something kind of like a mushy plasticky thing that looks like it's probably turned a little yellow with age. This is very, very nice, very solid looking, very crisp looking piece of transparent plastic molded to cover your Amiga.
Yeah, it's not one of those, as you said, just a soft plastic semi-shaped bag you throw over the top. So not only protects, it also allows you to almost have it on a static display.
Yep, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have. I got one of these GoTech drives, not from this particular seller, I don't think, because mine wasn't already set up for the Amiga. So these are kind of generic drives, and there's a procedure you can follow to flash the firmware to something that the Amiga will recognize, and I successfully did that. So I'm pretty happy. I played Pipe Dream once on an Amiga 500. Mm. that was about as far as I got with it, but
yeah, I just figured that for $34 already configured, ready to plug it into your Amiga is to me the way to go, rather than just getting the base unit and, as you said, getting the firmware set for what you want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the base unit wasn't much cheaper than this at all, if at all. No. I mean, so.
Yep, cool. I'm actually very impressed by how inexpensive that floppy emulator is.
Yeah, I bought two because it just didn't seem like it cost enough.
If something is too cheap, buy more of them. All right, cool. Paul, what do you have for us? You have a plethora of items.
Yes, I have many things. So some of them PC related, but the first one, this sort of caught my attention. There's a seller who is selling two vintage Sinclair ZX80 personal computers. One of them looks pretty normal, and that is not the one that I linked to. But if you sort of search through the listings, you find a regular looking ZX80. They're both being bid up. The one I'm not linking to has a starting bid of $70, which doesn't seem that bad actually. The one I am linking to is, I'm not sure what to make of that. It's a ZX80, except for the keyboard is a ZX81. And I don't know if it's because it's been replaced or if it's just like a ZX80 shell around a ZX81. I don't know what it is. It's kind of weird. But two other people so far have also found it equally intriguing and have bid it up to $34. So this should still be listed by the time this goes out if you want to take a look and see if you can figure it out. I mean, there's nothing that would actually indicate whether it works or if inside it is a ZX81 or a ZX80, but I kind of like the shape of the ZX80, so I'm tempted by it. But and clearly, of course, the seller has no idea.
Right.
I mean, so didn't even notice the keyboard. I knew it looked weird. It took me a second to realize why it looked weird. But so I have a number of things that are kind of IBM themed, given that it's 5150 day. This first one is probably the weirdest thing I came across in this vein. It is a Triton Turbo XT. And so, again, it's a thing where the seller doesn't know what it is. The seller has said, Triton Turbo XT bridge connects a TI-99/4A to an IBM incomplete untested as is. So it's not actually an interconnect device. It is, in fact, an XT. It is It's a little PC in a box that you attach to your TI-99/4A in the side. And then you can sort of switch back and forth between being in PC mode or TI mode. And it seems like, to me, those seem like, I mean, maybe they aren't really, but they seem like such disparate technologies. Like, the TI-99/4A is so, like at the bottom of, on the bottom rung.
Yeah.
But I guess, whatever. I mean, we were also saying that so is the PC, so I guess they're sharing the space at the bottom rung. But yeah, so it's a little PC XT. It has a bunch of ports on the back. They have pictures of those, where you can plug in, you know, the video and various things. So it seems like an interesting thing. Probably does not come up very often. So if you're interested, you can take a look at it. I found a link that's sort of describing it on a site called mainbyte.com that sort of talks in a little bit more detail about what it is and how it works. And as far as I can tell, that auction is not incomplete, which means it's probably going to get bid up high.
It's got to be one of the strangest TI-99/4A add-ons I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really small, actually. I mean, like, I can see why you wouldn't think it's got a whole, like a whole XT in there. But I guess they didn't need much space. So
it's interesting that, it has a keyboard port and monitor outputs on the back. Isn't this thing just its own computer? Like, could you use this without using a TI-99/4A? Just, like, plug this baby in and let it go? I wonder what it's actually using. What it's using the TI-99/4A for, like for floppy drives or something, or what? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's puzzling.
I don't know. it's true. There's a fairly extended ad at this mainbyte.com site, which can probably illuminate some of this, but, use your present keyboard, it says. So I guess you don't have to use the keyboard. Yeah. You can use the same keyboard. I think the idea is that you can just sort of swap over into PC mode, but it does have plugs for something. Mice, maybe? I don't know. But probably not mice.
So what else you got for us, Paul?
Okay, so I have a series of PC-related things. I guess this was also, the Triton was also, but so a 5155 portable, which is a portable XT. I put these in my auctions every once in a while. This is a one that does not power up, basically. Otherwise, it looks perfectly good, and the starting bid is $10. It's a heavy thing, so the shipping, at least to me, is $65, but that's not much. So if nobody gets in on this, I mean, the fact that it doesn't power up doesn't scare me too much, because, I mean, if it doesn't, you know, start smoking when you turn it on, I think probably it's, you know, it might well just be a power supply.
Right.
And they're pretty cool things. It's an XT, but cool, right?
Yeah.
One thing I was going to say about the next auction I was going to link to is a 5150. I never did say this, I don't think, but I was thinking that it's actually surprisingly difficult to get a hold of an IBM 5150 because, you know, they were only on sale for about a year, and they did sell a lot, but they sold them to businesses that, you know, will throw out the old one when the new one comes.
Sure.
So there are a couple different versions of the 5150. The very earliest one, I think it could only take 64K on the main board. I think that's right. I think it says actually on the main board 64K. And then there was a revision B, and those usually have a B stamped on the back, and they have more screws that hold in the case, and the power supply casing inside is usually not black. And there's a couple of different markers. But so this auction that I'm linking to is I think, at least, you know, given the fact that there are only two screws holding the case in, is probably a revision A. So an even harder to find one than just a general 5150. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of cool.
Hmm.
I did luck into one. Like, the only reason I know any of this is because I decided, all right, it's iconic. I need to have one. But and then I sort of just lucked into one. It was relatively cheap and quite a low serial number, and one of these revision A's, and it works too.
Ooh, nice.
I turned it on and it went to basic. So and then I turned it off and it's been, you know, sitting there for 2 years. But it did once work. The same seller has another thing which I thought was kind of interesting. It's an IBM 3270, and I forget if we talked about this. It's IBM PC 3270. It is a hybrid between a PC XT and a 3270 terminal. It's basically an XT that's kind of got a bunch of stuff built in order to act like a 3270 terminal. And Michael, were you saying that those were the ones? Was that the one that you were shown right at the beginning?
No, the ones that we were doing were always with a separate card put in. We used to use predominantly the AttachMate series of 3270 emulator cards, both in the DOS and then the days, and then later on the Windows 3.1X type days. I don't ever recall seeing a IBM PC 3270 in any of the offices where I worked. We had a few other types of attachment cards, but they were all basically plug the card in and hook it up and run it. They didn't come from IBM pre-made or configured.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one seems like it's pretty elaborate, and I would have imagined that they are pretty rare. This is the second one I've seen, though, in like the past 6 months, so I don't know. but it is basically, I think, an XT with a whole set of attached cards inside, that help communicate with the keyboard and help communicate with the terminal on the other side. And there's I think if you want the full graphics capabilities of a 3270, then it takes like three cards. So there's almost no expansion availability anymore. This particular auction, it's currently bid up to $6. Shipping is set at free, which is insane, and probably is. It's probably an error, but I don't know if it's an error that the seller can fix. But it looks like it's got a hard drive in it, and at least some of those cards. It's not really clear to me that from the back if it has all the appropriate 3270 cards in it. But so it's not quite a workable system, I don't think, as a 3270 emulator. But it's kind of a weird PC. So there's that. Oh, and actually, there's in the show notes, I'll put a link to another, an information page about these. Mm-hmm. Okay, last couple things I will mention. I just today saw a DEC PDP 1134 listed. You see these on eBay very occasionally, and they're usually just completely beat up. Half of them's missing, and they want $25,000 or something. This is in Halethorpe, Maryland, and it has a starting bid of $2,000, which seems, absolutely reasonable. It's being sold apparently by somebody who knows what they're talking about. At least they describe in quite a bit of detail what they tested. There's a bunch of places in there where things weren't at hand, like the cable wasn't at hand, so something didn't get tested. But I think still, it looks like it's the kind of thing that you could actually make operational, and it looks like it's in nice shape.
It looks pretty clean. It does not look like it's been like just stuffed in a basement and had stuff dumped on it. Like, it looks like it's been standing probably in an appropriate kind of room for a while. Like, it's clean and externally it looks good. It has lights that turn on.
Yeah,
always a good sign.
I have to say, it has the sort of like maroon and red, plate at the top that says digital PDP 11.
But the rest is a little bit, the rest is a bit too modern for me.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Sadly, it doesn't look pretty. Mm. It looks clean.
Mm. I would love to use it. And funnily enough, it says may not ship to Australia. And if it did, it would cost a fortune.
Yeah, the shipping is freight only, and they do, the seller recommends, you go to Maryland and get with a U-Haul and pick it up.
Oh, yeah, I can really see me doing that. But,
yeah.
But, nice piece of kit. But, I think I'll stick with the older PDP-11s. More blinking lights and switches.
Hmm. Right, a little less of a workhorse. But
More of a show pony.
It is a nice auction.
It is.
I mean, like, it's as an auction, I like all the things that it did.
Mm.
took good pictures and tested things. And
yeah.
I'm sure it was a big pain to put that auction together, actually. So anyway, reasonably priced. I'll be interested to see what it goes for. I'm sure it's going to go for something. I mean, it's worth the $2,000 that it's starting at is low for what it is.
Hmm.
So, and then just because we can't stop talking about the Apollo 11, I saw something come up, and it sort of dovetails a little bit with the discussion of IBM and our long running discussions of Apollo 11. But there was an Apollo 11 IBM press kit that. I presume was basically contemporaneous with the Apollo 11 mission and was sort of talks about IBM's contributions, like all the things that IBM did in this mission. In the, you know, it had to do with basically their System 360 processing the data when it was coming down, and they have nice photos of labs with, you know, many huge boxes of computing equipment in them, and it's pretty cool thing, little self promotional. Thing. And it has a starting bid of $20, so it's not bad.
Mm. Nice.
And if you thought that was interesting, you can also look at the other things the seller has. At least as I'm recording this, there's actually press kits much like this for a whole bunch of other companies actually that the seller is listing. So if you wanted all the press kits that apparently the seller had collected in the past, there's one for General Dynamics and TRW, there's aerospace insulations where featuring somewhere there's a picture of someone holding out their hand and having a blowtorch applied to it to show like how strong the stuff is that they put on the Apollo capsule. Anyway, it's kind of interesting, not really retro computing exactly, except for the IBM one, but still kind of cool.
Nice.
I think that actually exhausted my list.
Yeah.
And a very nice list it was this episode.
Right.
Very nice. Very nice. All right. That is all we've got for this show. You will find show notes for this and all RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us at the forums that are in the Vintage Computer Federation site, which is at www.vcfed.org.
Do they have a gopher address for that?
vcfed.org/gopher.
Yeah.
We need that. You can follow the RCR on Twitter, at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group by searching for Retro Computing Roundtable, or just by going to facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. We welcome all sorts of feedback via email at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network, which you will find at throwbacknetwork.net, which includes all sorts of podcasts of people talking about old stuff. And as always, I'd like to remind you to please write a review, leave comments, give us lots of nice shiny stars on iTunes or wherever else you may be downloading this podcast. That's what brings us the big lulls. So, until next time, Retro Compute!